It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal government seeks to locate and pay more than 1,300 Wisconsinites in recovered wages. We dig in on the issue of back wages and hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Tout is district director in the Minneapolis District Office for the U.S. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So these Wisconsinites are owed more than $1.5 million in back wages recovered by your wage and hour division. What counts as unpaid back wages?
The wage and hour division is an agency within the U.S. Department of Labor, and the back wages represent monies that we collected as part of our routine enforcement. We enforce a number of worker protection laws. I think the one that impact most workers in our working lives is the Fair Labor Standards Act. So that is the law that affords workers the right to a minimum wage and to overtime protections. That's the bulk of the money that we collect comes from overtime wages, but we also enforce protections that are specific to agricultural workers, to workers that are here on visas, foreign guest worker visas. So the monies represent back wages under a number of different protections. But the industries where we see the most violations are food service, healthcare, and construction. Those would be the primary ones in Wisconsin.
Why do you think those specific industries have more unpaid back wages?
I think that there's a number of reasons why. There are probably pay practices that are longstanding practices. In food service, for example, we see practices in, for example, the back of the house where workers are treated and paid as salaried workers. So think of line cooks or a dishwasher who might get a fixed salary and work 60 hours. There might be a misconception that if you pay a salary to a worker, you don't have to pay overtime. In construction, there are practices to pay perhaps a day rate or pay for the pieces completed. So footage and drywall or piece rates and roofing. There also are practices to treat workers in certain industries, in particular in construction, as independent contractors, when in fact an evaluation under the laws we enforce might indicate that that worker is entitled to wage protections and would have to be treated as employees. And then we would find that they would be due overtime wages.
So, Kristen, how does Wisconsin compare to other states regarding the amount of unclaimed wages?
Wisconsin, so by the district I serve covers the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin, and we had a comparable number. So in Minnesota, we have $2 million owed, and Wisconsin's comparable with $1.5 million. Overall, in the country, there's a number of $161 million that the wage and hour division recovered, but then couldn't locate those workers. That's 222,000 workers owed $161 million. So in Wisconsin, with the $1.5 million owed to 1,300 Wisconsin workers, we are doing our best to locate these workers. Normally, when we conduct an investigation and identify that back wages are owed, it's the customary practice that that employer would issue the back wage checks at the time the investigation concludes. So this money represents the share of back wages owed to workers who we couldn't find. The workers who are those who might have moved or changed jobs. So the monies that we identify as unpaid and to these workers who we couldn't locate, it's really a priority to get the monies to them. The money is held by the wage and hour division for 3 years before it's turned over to the Treasury. And so it really is important to get that money to workers. And this money that's owed in Wisconsin is an average of $1,400, if I did my math correctly. $1,400 average to a food service worker or to a construction worker or to a healthcare worker is a rent payment or an ability to pay off debt or a month of groceries.
It's significant. So yes.
It is. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about unclaimed wages with Kristen Tout, Minneapolis District Director for the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. You can call in. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Kristen, you know, the department says a significant portion of money remains unclaimed wages because some workers, as you said, can't be located. How can people find out if they have unpaid back wages?
Yes, there is an online tool, and it's straightforward and simple to use. The Department of Labor's website is accessed at dol.gov. Once you get to dol.gov, do a search for workers owed wages. Once you get to workers owed wages, there is a search you do for your employer. So you first find your employer. Once you find your employer, you look for yourself. So we encourage people who, if you have found your employer and you look for yourself, if you find yourself, then it's relatively simple to enter basic information and submit a claim. I don't want people to be discouraged if they find their employer and don't find themselves, because they should reach out to us at our 866 number, which is 866-4-US-WAGE. To check in with us and see if for some reason they might have had a name change. There might be some reason why they didn't find themselves.
Other discrepancies, yes. So you mentioned 3 years. Is that how long people have to claim these unpaid wages?
That is. So once that money is paid to the Wage and Hour Division, we hold it for that 3-year window of time. And then after that 3-year period, we're required to turn it over to the U.S. Treasury.
How does your agency work with, like, the State Department of Workforce Development, which, you know, at the state level also is dealing with wage discrepancies for employees?
That's a great question. We have a partnership with the Department of Workforce Development and are regularly in contact and working through deconfliction and making determinations as to who would best handle a certain case. So they are a partner, and we can engage in information sharing with that partner. We also, with other stakeholders, have plans where we have cases with large numbers of unlocated workers, do engage with those stakeholders to So for example, a worker advocacy organization who could help us identify unlocated workers.
Kristen Tout leads the Minneapolis District Office for the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division as we discuss claiming back wages and how to do it. Call in with the question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Labor Department asks workers to use its new search tool to determine if they are owed back wages, and if so, how to claim the money. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your concerns at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Tout is the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division District Director at the Minneapolis District Office. Kristen, in terms of taxes, are reclaimed wages taxable income?
Yes. Well, generally, wages are taxed at the same level they were that the workers, when they earned those wages. So when an employer would pay back wages. And I always recommend employers consult with their tax attorney. So I try not to provide tax advice as a general rule. But when workers started work, they completed a W-4. So when an employer pays back wages, they tax those back wages at the same level they tax the wages that were paid during the regular course of employment.
You know, what information do people really need to have in order to use your online search feature for these unpaid wages?
Sure. And the search tool, again, just by going to the DOL.gov and doing a search for workers owed wages, bring people right to that online tool. And there are 5 simple steps. So searching for the employer and then searching for themselves and entering some basic contact information. There is a process where they would submit some identifying information. And once they do that, they can submit a claim. And that claim will go to the region where that individual worked, and it will be a 6-week processing time to receive their back pay.
What consequences are there for the businesses that owe unpaid wages?
So the back wages that would be the businesses that owe back wages, and this would be addressed in the course of doing the investigation. When we identify under the law I mentioned at the beginning, the Fair Labor Standards Act, a failure to pay the wages that are owed to workers, failure to pay minimum wage and overtime, we, as a regular course of calculating unpaid wages, would seek the money that was owed. And in many cases, would also seek an equal amount in damages. So it would be the wages owed as well as the equal damages. And those go to the workers. There are also consequences potentially if violations are willful that the employer would owe a penalty. So wages and liquidated damages, we don't consider those penalties. Those are monies that go to workers. Hmm. But for violations where there's a practice that we determine this business knew what was required and failed to follow those requirements, there could be additional penalties. So it could be expensive to be out of compliance. It's better for businesses to be informed and to be paying wages as required.
I was just going to jump in and say that this search tool, it reminds me of how states run their unclaimed property divisions and searching for unclaimed property. And I'm wondering, would back wages be part of other databases like unclaimed property?
So again, the back wages that we're talking about that are on the workers' owed wages tool, these are monies we have already collected. So the investigation's complete and the Wage and Hour Division has already collected them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair point that they are similar to property. That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. They are monies that are collected and available and ready to be paid out to workers.
Kristen, are there programs in place that seek out people who are owed wages, or are individuals responsible for finding and claiming them?
There are, through our enforcement actions, and then once the money is collected, the department is proactive in searching for people. Hmm. So through the records that we had available in our investigation, so the last contact information through social security numbers, through phone numbers, we do our best to locate. So we're proactive on that end, but the workers may have moved or changed their names, or employers may not have kept all of the information they were required to keep. So we are looking and being in through this tool on all fronts trying to access workers. And so this is a way for workers to be proactive in doing their own search and reaching out to us.
We're talking about unpaid back wages with Kristen Tout with us, Minneapolis District Director for the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. Call in with questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen, you mentioned H-1B visas earlier, allow some non-citizens to work specialized jobs in the United States. How does this issue affect immigration workers or people who are on H-1B visa status?
Yes, and the back wages that would be collected through our enforcement and not only H-1B visas, but visas for agricultural workers, which is the H-2A visa, and then H-2B is for non-agricultural workers. So there are a number of programs through that enable foreign guest workers to be in the United States and working. And we have certain enforcement actions that we take to ensure these actions protect both U.S. workers as well as those foreign workers. And there are there's wages that we find owed to all workers, H-1B, H-2A, and H-2B. So certainly, as I mentioned at the beginning, the bulk of the wages that we found owed to Wisconsin workers are really resulting from overtime wages that are unpaid in food service, in construction, and in healthcare. But we do certainly find violations in some of the immigration programs.
Samantha in Whitehall called in and is wondering, what would happen if back wages are owed by an employer that is going out of business?
That's a great question. There's an employer who's going out of business. There's a potential that individual employer, the individual person would have liability, as well as if that individual owned other businesses, there's a potential that money could be collected. So when employers go out of business, it may be a challenge to collect money. The Wage and Hour Division enforcement of a business that's closing may be challenged, in particular if there's bankruptcy involved. So the monies that we're talking about here that have been collected and that are available are monies that have already been collected through enforcement efforts. But if there is a business that is closing, that may be the collections where there isn't money available does pose some challenges.
Kristen, is this Labor Department search tool like a first iteration for the department, or have you had this way of looking up back wages in the past?
The tool has been in place for some time, but we're really emphasizing it now to ensure that workers access this money. There's been some enhancements to it, and so we are promoting it and encouraging workers to come forward and use it.
What would you say are the biggest enhancements? What is making this tool better?
The ease of use and the simplicity, I think are the best enhancements. So really just being able to find the employer and then find yourself has made it a little bit easier to use.
In terms of then the claims process, and you file that claim for those wages, you find your name, is that process generally the same amount of time, or could it be longer or shorter?
Yeah, the process of identifying the employer, then yourself, and then having some simple documentation that you submit is really about a 6-week process. So we've tried to reduce the amount of time that it takes to just go through the system to secure those back wages.
Okay. Well, Kristen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to be with you.
Kristen Tout is district director in the Minneapolis District Office for the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Department of Transportation seeks public input in drafting updates to the official state highway map. And these maps, they have a long tradition, guiding travelers in Wisconsin for over a century. As we discuss map making, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ginther is our cartographic specialist in the State Transportation Department's Bureau of Technical Services. Katie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And David Layton is here, the Bureau's Section Chief for Surveying and Mapping. David, welcome back.
Good morning. Great to be back.
So, David, starting with you, the Transportation Department is asking for public input for the 2025 version of the official state highway map. Why does the map need updating?
Well, we're changing how we produce the map. We've done it we went to a digital process about 35 years ago, and technology has changed. So we're changing with the times and updating how we produce the map, trying to leverage some existing maps that we have and be more efficient. And we thought it would be a good time to reach out to the public and take input, you know, since we're changing the way we make the map, you know, maybe there's some other things that we look to change along the way. And it might not just be for 2025. You know, we only have about 10 months left in our production process. So the input we take will carry forward to future editions as well.
What input are you hearing so far?
Katie's kind of the expert keeping tabs on that, but what she's filled me in on, you know, kind of runs the range. We've got some people that maybe would like the map simplified, and we've got other people that have said, you know, maybe leave it the way it is.
Katie, what stands out to you from the comments that are coming in?
Yeah, well, first I'd like to say we're really excited with the amount of responses we've gotten so far. As of this morning, there's been over 700 responses. A lot of really great feedback, people taking the time to sort of write detailed comments of either what they like about the map or what they'd like to see changed. Some common themes are, like David said, you know, the level of detail seems like a highly contested subject on the map. Some people think the level of detail is too much and the print is too small, making the map too hard to read. Others would like to see more detail, maybe some more, you know, bike trails or recreation or other sort of information. So that's so please, you know, a survey and let's sort of break this tie up if it's too much detail or too little.
Yes.
Another another thing we're seeing a lot is the ability for maybe some potential other mapping products as well. People are like, you know what, I love the state map, but I would like to see something maybe at a county level or city level as well.
Okay, so you're trying to strike a balance with the amount of detail and perhaps clutter to the eye and other options for maps. So how do you ensure that a map remains legible?
Yeah, so one of the biggest things with thinking about a print map is the hierarchy of data on the map. So for first and foremost, the state highway map is a highway map, you know, produced by the DOT. So that road data needs to be, you know, hierarchy level one. And so I'm looking at the map and thinking about how I can display and symbolize and use color and font to make sure that that highway data is legible and readable and stands out. And then we start thinking about sort of the supporting layers behind that, sort of points of interest, lakes and rivers, this other supporting information that's on the map, and make sure it doesn't compete, you know, visually with that highway and is more as a point of reference to the public.
Ooh, you mentioned fonts. I'm wondering, do you use like serif or sans serif fonts?
Yeah, so in cartography, one of the ongoing rules is to use the sans serif for political and serif fonts for more geographic. And this sort of divides the information into those two categories just by the font type.
Wow, I had no idea. So like, so sans serif, meaning the fonts that don't have little flourishes at the end, serif fonts having those flourishes. Explain again, you were breaking up just a bit. Explain how you distinguish between the two.
Sure. So for serif fonts, those ones that have sort of more flourishes on them, those would be used for physical features. So we're talking lakes, rivers, mountain ranges, that type of thing. And I think the thought is that they look a little more, you say, organic. So they kind of fit the organic feel of those features, whereas political features such as towns and cities, those get those more static, non-serif fonts.
Oh, interesting. Katie Ginther there, cartographic specialist. David Layton with us, surveying and mapping chief, as we talk about a new draft of the official state highway map. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. David, map making is traditionally a data-driven process, you know, reviewing where landmarks are around the state. How can public input affect how you draw the new map?
Well, it can affect, you know, what data layers we show, and how much of those data layers that we show. You know, given the scale of the map, you have to filter out some data so you don't show, you know, every lake and river. You know, there's compromises that we make to choose. And so what we're looking for from the public is, you know, how do they use the map? How has it changed? What things might be important for them to see?
And what things might be important for them to see?
Well, you know, I think even taking a step back from just the front of the map itself, you know, there's the mileage log in the upper right-hand corner that gives you, you know, major cities, and you can kind of find the intersection of those cities and find out how many miles it is. There's the index information. There's the city inset maps on the back. There's the information that we produce collectively with the Department of Tourism, you know, really be interested to know, you know, as times have changed, are people still finding those things valuable? Would they like something else to, you know, would they like less city inset maps because they can get that information elsewhere and maybe more other content? Now, that's probably not something that we would implement this year in 2025. But again, we're looking for inspiration, not just for the 2025 map that's going to be published next year, but for the additions beyond that as well.
So as times change, people also change. I mean, it might be that people are growing up without ever needing to actually use a map or figure out where you are or, you know, to plot your course or your mileage logs. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we want to try to meet the needs of our users, and certainly times change, but I think the map still remains a very popular product. We've distributed around I think 400,000 copies in the last year. And you know, there's times when you still benefit and need a paper map, but it gives you perspective. You can see the whole state at once. Maybe if you're traveling up north, you know, you don't have a good cell signal or GPS signal, or your phone dies, it's nice to have that map there with you.
Katie, do you have insights there why paper maps are still such a necessity when we have maps readily available on our phones and our cars?
Yeah, so I think, you know, cartography has evolved over the years from print cartography to more digital cartography. And we're not trying to, you know, compete with the GPS systems. A print map obviously can't offer sort of turn by turn directions. But people like to see an overall view for pre-planning purposes. You know, plan a trip, it's great to see, you know, an overall view where you can plot, you know, what your trip is going to look like. Another big use of print cartography now is just showing geographic data, our data in a geographic form. So we saw this a lot sort of during the pandemic where people were mapping the spread of disease in a geographic area. And that sort of helped tell a story much more clearly to the public than maybe just, you know, rattling off the stats. So that's a huge other area of print cartography now is, you know, using it as data to support your story.
I wonder about like the topography, the features on the map, like elevations and where water bodies are, because, you know, amid climate change, we've got lakes that are shrinking, lakes that are growing, maybe. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, so we actually are currently working with the state cartographer's office to rebuild a new lakes and rivers layer for the state highway map. The DNR does maintain this data and has a great detailed data source for us to draw from. And we do need to like think about drawing this data in every, you know, couple years, because we can't sit here and assume that that information isn't changing.
Katie Ginther is a cartographic specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation's Bureau of Technical Services. David Layton is with us, Section Chief of Surveying and Mapping. Call in with your question. You can add comments on maps 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Transportation Department wants public input on shaping the future of the official state highway map. The map has been circulated for generations, and now cartographers hope new technology can improve it. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David Layton is Section Chief of Surveying and Mapping at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. And Katie Ginther is with us, a cartographer in the department. Katie, Phil from Mount Pleasant called in and asks, how often should you buy a new paper map? When should a map be replaced?
Yeah, so the maps are actually free to the public, so you don't need to purchase them. You can find them at any rest stop or welcome area, or order them directly from our website free of charge. Currently, we update the map every 2 years. So the latest edition was in 23, and the next one will come out in 25. So I would say every 2 years, pick up the latest edition.
David, how significantly does the state's highway system shift between mappings?
Well, you know, I think back 20 years ago, we saw a lot more changes as we were building out some more freeways and expressways. But generally speaking, I think the highway system is pretty stable. But there's always things that we're looking to update and keep current. So there's a lot of little details, a little nuances. Probably one of the biggest things I think that changed in the last edition was cities and villages. You know, we had a new census, so that changed, you know, what cities and villages got shaded in, and it changed the population values that are listed in the index. So there's a lot more that goes into keeping the map updated beyond just the highway system.
And I would imagine you don't ever want people to say, using it, this wasn't on the map. What is this?
Absolutely.
Oh dear. So Katie, your agency says it'll be using geographic information system programs for drafting this new map. What are the advantages to mapping with GIS?
Yeah, so currently the map is in computer-aided design or CAD software, and some of the problems with that is that the map exists sort of just as a static drawing. There's not, it doesn't lay on top of sort of a geographic structure. So it isn't actually in a correct geographic projection right now. And sort of the live geographic information that is constantly being produced by federal and state agencies can't be directly fed into the map because it's just not compatible. So when we rebuild it with geographic information software, GIS, this allows us to have that framework to allow information straight from those agencies that's, you know, constantly being edited and updated by the experts in those agencies to come directly into the map. So therefore, if someone, you know, in the DNR edits what the bounds of a state forest look like, I can open the map document on my end and that update will automatically be there. So obviously this is going to save us, you know, a lot of time and effort in updating and publishing the map in the future.
You have that more of that usability and transferability, but I imagine you have to, this is a really careful, detailed process though.
Yes, for sure. So this, you know, I started at the DOT 7 months ago and I've been working on it nonstop and will be until the 25 edition comes out because there are over 50 layers and 18 inset maps on the map. So each section of information needs to find that sort of data source. We need to refine it to fit the map scale, and we need to filter it out to, you know, the information that's applicable at that scale.
Wow.
So there's a lot of considerations for every single one of those layers and thinking about how we can best set it up now so that process for future versions can be easier to update.
More seamless. Yes. Let's bring in a call now. Jean in Madison. Jean, hi. Go ahead.
Good morning. I joined a little late, but I just love this conversation, and I absolutely love paper maps. I love books that have maps, and I have maps under plastic on my dining room table, and I have fond memories of sitting in the car on road trips with my family, and my dad would be driving, and I would be moving my finger along the map, whether it was a big map or the gazetteer, you know, for local things, and I would just always love to map. So that's just a comment. Thank you.
Jean, thank you. And I hope you get your official highway, state highway map. David, when did you start to be attracted to maps? And what did they mean for you?
Similarly to our last caller, I when I was a kid, I was in the back seat and we'd go on a road trip and I'd be the navigator for the car. So I have very fond memories of following along on the highway maps and figuring out where we were and telling my dad where to go.
I remember AAA triptychs, you know, and being able to finally flip to the next page because we were making progress. Katie, when did you become attracted to maps and map making?
Yeah, so I originally was coming from a more graphic design or design standpoint. I always liked, you know, creating infographics and you know, making data more tenable through design. And originally I wanted to do, you know, graphic design or interior design or some other kind of design. I didn't even know about the world of cartography. But when I was at UW-Madison, I realized I had a really strong cartography program. So I thought this is the perfect marriage of my ability to design plus having that sort of data-driven design, and I really like playing with those elements.
How do you feel about maps that are not to scale? Like, let's say you are on a trip and you visit a zoo and you get this map that is totally not to scale.
Yeah, so there are some maps that I think function more as, you know, fun images, and that serves a purpose, you know, for example, zoos and kids visiting the zoo, they need to point, you know, to the picture of the hippo and go there. So I don't want to, you know, on what makes a good map.
You're so kind.
Very different purposes.
We're talking about a new draft of the official state highway map and all its layers with Katie Ginther, cartographic specialist, and David Layton, surveying and mapping chief at the State Transportation Department. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. David, as you get out your crystal ball here, how do you imagine the way state highway maps are displayed? How could that change in the next decade or longer?
Well, I'm not a prognosticator, so I'd hate to speculate on something like that. I think there's a lot of history and tradition, and you know, I think we're going to continue to build off of that. But you know, looking for public input again. We've got this survey out there for people. It runs through the end of the month, and looking forward to hearing what people have to say. You know, what's important to them, what they'd like to see more of, maybe what they'd like to see less of, we'll take that as inspiration, both to see maybe what changes we might make in 2025 as we rebuild how we make the map and carry anything else beyond that as well.
Katie, as you look at really old Wisconsin highway maps and think about the maps of the future, what contrasts might you envision?
Yeah, so I think, you know, historically maps were meant more for navigation. And I think in the future, over the, you know, past 100 years, there's been more, you know, tourism elements added. So it becomes more of a promotional tool for the state. So if, you know, driving along, passing into the state for the first time, pick up a map at the Welcome Center, and it sort of is an introduction to the state. So thinking about maybe the map less as navigation and more as sort of a tourist or promotional information, and even like a launch pad to share our other mapping products, or maybe possibly even an interactive version of the map.
So kind of like a gateway to other sources of information.
Exactly.
Yeah. David, is that how you see the official state highway map?
I think it's certainly a good possibility as it continues to evolve. Absolutely.
Well, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy map making. David Layton is surveying and mapping chief for the State Department of Transportation. Katie Ginther is a cartographic specialist for the State Department of Transportation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a new collection of prose poems from Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman. Her works chronicle her childhood onset of obsessive-compulsive disorder and that journey into adulthood with an anxiety disorder causing repeated unwanted thoughts and fears. Be part of this conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Marie Hoffman's poetry collection is called Exploding Head. Cynthia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So your collection is split into four sections. The first section is from the perspective of a child. Did any of these events you write about happen in your childhood, or are they artistic metaphors about your childhood?
Oh, this is such a funny question, because actually my father read the poems just recently, last fall, when the advanced reading copy was out, and he said, well, I hope you imagined most of these things. I hope these are metaphors, but no, these are actually the thoughts that were going through my head at the time. It's quite scary to be a child with OCD when you have fears that come out of nowhere.
How did you, document those fears as a child? Did you just hold them through the years and then they come later in life pouring out through poetry as you become a poet? Or how did you hold on to these?
Exactly. I did hold on to them. I didn't tell anyone. And I think it was because a lot of the obsessions that can come with OCD aren't the types of things that it's okay to talk about generally in conversations. Fears of getting shot or fears that someone will break into your home, worrying constantly about being in a car accident. These things are just brushed off by others as don't worry about it. You know, it makes you feel like, especially when you're a child, you're the only one having these types of thoughts. No one else seems concerned. So there must be something wrong with me. And I decided that certainly if there was anything wrong with me, I was going to keep it secret. So I actually started writing about OCD when I was already about 35. And it was really the first time I had spoken more publicly, you know, with my poetry group around the dining room table in my own home, but to people that weren't my close family. And everything did sort of come spilling out through poetry. It gave me a way of speaking about things in an artistic platform that I had full control over, that space on the page. And it just felt like it was a way for me to express those things that I didn't have another outlet to express them in.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, did you feel any stigma or shame as you sat around your poetry circle at the table in talking about something so deeply personal as this anxiety disorder?
I think I worried that I would feel that way, but my poetry group was such a supportive group and collection of peers, and they really made me feel comfortable. When I first brought the poems, I said, I'm writing about something new, but I don't want to talk about what it is. I just want the poems to speak for themselves. I wasn't quite ready to say, I have OCD, this is OCD. I just wanted to show a bare, clean, non-labeled look inside my mind.
There are images and themes that come up through the collection, including an angel. What is the angel you write about?
The angel was actually a figure that appeared in my room when I was a little child. I'm not sure where he came from. Of course, I did go to Sunday school when I was a kid. I went to church. There was some religion in my house. So it could obviously came from that. The idea of angels always fascinated me when I was little. I wanted to have an angel costume and dress up as an angel at Christmas. But this angel figure was not a guardian angel for me. It was something that was terrifying. And I just felt the presence of him standing there at night by my closet door. You know, as kids are afraid of things in the dark, I was afraid of an angel. And I had in my mind the idea that this angel, if I didn't cover my ear with the sheet at night, my ear was bare, the angel would approach my bed and lean over and whisper the secret of heaven. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why this was scary to me. And that's why I think that the angel got wrapped up in the idea of OCD for me. As I thought about what are my OCD symptoms, the angel seemed to be a part of that because there were these strange rules that were just there. They were associated with this angel. I had to cover my ear.
We're talking with Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman. A new book of poetry, it's called Exploding Head. You can join in with questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Cynthia, you establish a pattern of thought that you characterize as a game and rules. And in your poem, Conquerors, you write, you have your own game and you must play it quietly in your mind. And the rules are, if you don't count, you'll die. What did you mean by the game and the rules?
I guess it sounds a little bit like the childhood game of step on a crack and break your mother's back. OCD comes just assigned with these rules. If I do X, I'll be protected by Y. And so I think ultimately I was afraid of dying and still am. I want to live. I love my family. I love my life. I want to be alive and enjoy it. And so that's my biggest fear. It wraps up in everything. And OCD clamps itself onto whatever your biggest fear is, whatever you don't want to lose. And for me, I think just at a base level, that's my life. And I think that just the rules coming in quietly in my mind represented the idea that I had to keep it secret, that I didn't do anything really that was physically visible. Like I wasn't walking through a door 15 times to get out the door in the morning to school, things like that, that other people would notice. It was all internal, these mental compulsions to count and draw patterns on things, all in my head quietly.
You know, when I think of Conker, it's the British game using those little horse chestnut tree seeds and that idea of you strike the opponent's Conker and try to break it. Did you feel like there were these instances where things or people were striking out at you and trying to break you in some way?
I don't think so. I don't think
Okay.
others were trying to break me, but I think that it was the idea of breaking something open. I was fascinated by what's hidden inside. And you're right, Conkers is that British game. I lived in England when I was little, and my sister and I played Conkers. We loved it. It was so fun. And I kept the title in the book, even though I thought people might not know in the US what Conkers is. So I'm glad you know that game. And I think that it was just, the idea of holding so much inside and a fascination with how that might be eventually broken open.
Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman, new collection of poems. It's called Exploding Head, Navigating a Life with Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We discuss a new collection of image-rich poems called Exploding Head that give a glimpse of what it's like to live with obsessive-compulsive disorder, which the National Institutes of Health characterizes as uncontrollably recurrent thoughts, known as obsessions, and repetitive behaviors, referred to as compulsions. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. This is the fourth poetry collection by Cynthia Marie Hoffman of Madison. Let's bring in a call now, Jenny in Evansville. Jenny, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the topic. I was diagnosed with OCD when I was about 20, and I'm 50 years old now. So I guess I just want to underscore the fact that OCD is a very unique journey. It differs so much from person to person. Mine in particular manifested with germs. And today I'm very high functioning. I still very much live with it. It's just a part of me that I've come to accept. I'll have business meetings and be in all sorts of situations, and no one around me knows that I'm functioning with a certain set of rules. So, it's something that I don't hide it, but I also don't want it to be the focus. And so when I do confide in someone new and explain to them, oh, I have this characteristic or this disorder, the first thing that they usually start doing is trying to accommodate for it. Oh, well, does this bother you? Does that bother you? And
how does that make you feel?
Actually, I'm the kind of person that I like to make the people around me feel at ease. And so I have learned to be very careful who I share that with. And it needs to be someone whom I can trust, so that I can say to them, look, I will let you know.
Yeah.
Please do not try. I think the hard thing is they have empathy and they want to try to accommodate. But what they don't understand, it is absolutely not rational. For example, I can drink out of a coffee mug in a restaurant, but I cannot drink out of a glass.
Jenny, I really appreciate you sharing your very personal journey with OCD. And Cynthia Marie Hoffman, what comes up as you hear Jenny's story?
Oh, thank you so much, Jenny, for sharing. All of that rung true for me, especially the loneliness when you're keeping something inside. And even if you aren't attempting to hide it or trying to not show your OCD, it's a very isolating disorder. And people who have OCD who have read my book say that the main thing that I think rang true for them was especially the childhood section, where it is just terribly lonely. And I don't think I even realized how alone I was until I wrote the book. I went back and I read it and I thought, I was terribly isolated. And it's only now that I'm starting to find a community of others in the OCD community and within the poetry community who have OCD, who are willing to support each other and say, yeah, that's exactly what it feels like for me. And that connection has been, for me, so powerful.
How did your life change after a firm diagnosis?
Actually, the idea of a firm diagnosis is a little fuzzy for me because since I kept everything so internal, and also because most of my compulsions and obsessions were mental and other people weren't necessarily recognizing it in me. No one brought me to therapy or identified it for me. I just knew something was wrong. And I don't know how, but somehow I ended up with a copy of Dr. Judith Rapoport's 1991 book, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. And I think I was probably 16 and just driving at the time when that book fell into my hands. The very first case study in that book is about a man who worries that he might have run over someone with his car. And he's wondering, am I sure I didn't drive over someone with my car? I don't know. It's something about OCD causes you to lose your faith in your own memory and in your own experience. That's why sometimes we hear about people with OCD checking, did you turn off the stove? Checking, did you lock it? Because as soon as you do it, you think, did I really do that? And I had that very idea driving, you know, as a 16-year-old, did I really kill somebody? How do I know that I didn't? You know, there's this doubt. OCD has long been called the doubting disease. You know, and that's really what it is. So I knew all the things that I had been experiencing, those were OCD. That explained it for me. And I was just sure that I had this. And so I did a lot of self-help books over the years. And again, I think it was just the stigma and the secrecy that kept me from finding therapy. I did seek therapy for conditions that go along with OCD, like depression and anxiety. Cognitive behavioral therapy can be very helpful, but for OCD, it needs to be something specifically targeted, like a cognitive behavioral therapist who understands OCD, or exposure and response prevention therapy.
We're talking about a new poetry collection called Exploding Head. Madison-based poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman is here, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Stephen in Madison now. Stephen, hi.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, yeah. I would love to. So I'm someone that is more newly diagnosed with OCD. I found out recently from my psychiatrist it takes on average 17 years from onset of symptoms to diagnosis. For me, it was a big, oh, so that's what that is kind of moment. I still personally feel a little unequipped to write about it. And I'm wondering how it's affected your writing, and specifically if you feel like it gets in the way of your ability to write, or does it help in some way?
Thank you, Stephen. That's a great question. Cynthia?
That is a great question. By the way, this is Stephen Espada Dawson calling in. He is our Madison Poet Laureate.
Oh,
and
wow.
Also has OCD. Thank you so much, Stephen, for sharing that with us. I think OCD gets in the way of writing in the same way that it gets in the way of my life. I have this obsessive need to just read things over and over again after I've written them. And it's sad. I often think, how much could I have accomplished in my life if I didn't have to read this email I've already sent 5 or 10 or 15 more times after sending it? I could just send it and move on with my day. And in some ways, that obsessive rereading helps with revision. It really causes me to be extra tuned into the musicality of language and the rhythm of it. I read things in my mind. When I'm practicing my poetry and I'm revising, I read things out loud and hear it. But as far as writing about OCD, it isn't anything I thought of doing until I was 35. It took me, you know, I wrote 3 other full-length collections before I thought of truly writing about myself.
I wonder, do you set aside time then to write like an exercise that you do each day with your writing and poetry? Or do you just decide that, you know, it strikes you in the moment where you sit down and work on a new collection?
Well, I think as poets, we're often taught, or we hear the message that we wait for the muse to arrive.
Yeah.
And I think that poets could really benefit from the philosophy of novelists who just sit in the chair. And something that has kept me sitting in the chair and showing up for my own creativity and my own work is having a poetry community around me and having a poetry group that I'm sharing work with. Because for a while, in fact, I didn't, for a period of about 5 years, I wasn't writing at all. And I didn't have a poetry group at that time. And my friends started up a new group and I said, well, I'm not writing, but I'll join anyway. And all of a sudden you have a peer saying, when's your poem? You know, where's your poem?
You
need
accountability.
A poem for next Thursday. Exactly. So it's truly helpful. And if you show up for your work, then the muse will arrive.
Mm. The theme of guilt comes up in some of your poetry. Can you explain a little bit more about such feelings of guilt?
I think that probably just comes from OCD. And it's something where you have a feeling of guilt that just shows up out of nowhere, and then your mind responds to that sensation in your body and says, what have I done? You know, what have, I say this in one of the poems in my book, what have you done? And I don't think I could ever come up with the answer. When I was a child, I had these terrible dreams that I had murdered someone. And again, I think it goes back to that Judith Rapoport book and that case study where you start to think, am I sure I know what I've done? And OCD for many years was known as like scrupulosity. So really, really wanting to be perfect and to be good and worrying about sinning too much. And so I think that really showed itself for me in my OCD as well.
Poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman of Madison focuses her new collection on her journey with obsessive compulsive disorder from childhood to adulthood. It's called Exploding Head, and we're discussing these poems. Be part of the discussion at any point. You can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book of evocative prose poetry. It chronicles a childhood onset and an adult journey through obsessive-compulsive disorder, a mental health condition characterized by obsessions and compulsions that interfere with life, with living. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman's new collection is called Exploding Head. Cynthia, can you read a poem for us, Exploding Head Syndrome, and if you could share that poem with us?
Sure. Exploding Head Syndrome. You are finally an adult, living with roommates in a house with a rickety banister and soft spots in the floor when your head begins exploding at night. First, a swish like a heavy wing dragging across the air, and then the door slams. Where does one life end and another begin? When you were a child, your thumb or your mother's thumb was slammed in the car door. One of you felt the pain, one of you the guilt. But you cannot remember which was which. You often dreamed of a guilt so grave you fell to your knees in the garden. Tadpoles shuddered in their leafy beds. What have you done? Once, a red balloon sailed to the ceiling of a warehouse, and though the ribbon slipped from your or your sister's fingers, you cannot remember which. You know the empty hand. You are always running from the shadow that chases you. In the forest at night, an owl screams a womanly, murderous scream. Neighbors call the police. You and your sister and your mother set out with the dog and a flashlight and find nothing.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. Why did you choose this poem to share the title of your book?
It's funny because as I look at this collection, Exploding Head Syndrome, the title of this book, Exploding Head, is really the only syndrome or disorder that's diagnosed by name in the book. I don't say obsessive compulsive disorder anywhere in the poems themselves, but Exploding Head seemed to me like it encapsulated that feeling of your head is so packed full, and it's so busy with these obsessions and these mental compulsions. It just felt to me like it summarized the experience of OCD in a way.
You describe these poems as memoir in prose poems. Have you always written in prose?
I wrote stories when I was little and essays when I was a little older. And at some point I decided I'm a poet. You know, poems have line breaks. Poems are written in form, et cetera.
They rhyme.
And, right. Well, mine don't.
But yes, no.
they often do rhyme. So I think that I finally, as the years went on as a poet, fell back into the prose form. And I have a poem in the book called The Music of Language. Is opening up for you. The music of language is clamping down hard. And it's about my experience with OCD forcing me to rip onto little patterns of things that people say that have a certain number of syllables. They'll just hear, oh, that has six syllables. And that works if I look at the window pane and I count the four sides of the window and I draw an X through the middle. And I have this, you know, compulsion to repeat these phrases based on their musicality. And I think that that caused me as a young child to pay attention to language. And so in a way, OCD, I think, has given me the gift of poetry.
The book, it being written using the personal pronoun you and not I, why do you choose to use you?
I have a poem in the beginning of the book that says, "You are not you again today." And I think that that is kind of summarizing this sense that there's the OCD reality that we live in, which is kind of the not you. It's not truly who I am. It's a big part of me, but it's not my identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of my identity. And then there's the you, the true me who lives in the world. And I think also you is a way of creating a distance between myself and the subject. And when I first started writing these poems, it was just a more comfortable place for me to talk about, in a way, someone else and this other part of me that I had never shared before.
You mentioned religion and growing up in a spiritual community. And when I think about religion as well, there are rituals in religious services, a lot of rituals. How does that aspect affect living with OCD and in your poetry?
You're right. There are a lot of rituals associated with religion. And I don't think that my upbringing was religious enough to have brought a lot of those rituals into the home. Mm-hmm. But I do remember, of course, praying every night and saying, if I die before I wake, etc. And I think that that's probably a part of what brought the angel into my room as well. This idea that you spend the night before you go to bed connecting with a spiritual entity and connecting with God or an angel or whatever my concept was at the time.
Well, how did that make you feel, that connection before trying to fall asleep? Was that helpful or harmful?
I think it was harmful. It was definitely terrifying. I don't, mm-hmm. you know, that prayer that we say, it really calls to mind the idea that you might die before you wake up the next morning. You know, mm-hmm. I was a kid. I was already pretty in tune with poetry and language and the meaning of things. And that didn't get past me. That wasn't just something I recited. I felt that in my soul every night that I might die. And so I think that, again, I think that probably, you know, conjured the angel in my mind in some way, that I was making a connection to something spiritual that was scary.
New poetry book, Exploding Head. We're talking with Madison Bay's poet, Cynthia Marie Hoffman. You can join in with your questions. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book guides the reader through a series of thoughts and perspectives as well as experiences. And one poem is titled, This Is All True, and includes like this list of experiences that are written almost like instructions. What is this poem about?
So This Is All True is kind of, you're right, instructions. Instructions for Cynthia Marie Hoffman's OCD. It's a list of all the things, or some of the things, that were compulsions or concerns for me. And I think that this poem in particular, some of the lines are, if your foot dangles off the edge of the bed, a metal blade rises from the floor and slices it off. How do you know you haven't murdered someone accidentally? Look directly at the sun, touch your eyeball once a day. These are all kind of, you know, OCD rules that are made up when I was a child. And I think that this poem kind of says, when I say this is an OCD memoir in prose poetry, or this is an OCD poem, I've been saying that and kind of announcing it as my elevator pitch for this book, imagining that that creates automatically a rich, full understanding in others of what an OCD poem might be. But I'm learning the more, or I'm reminded the more that I talk about this book, that there's a great misunderstanding about what encompasses OCD, what OCD can possibly be. You know, as Jenny said earlier, it manifests itself so differently in different people. So people might not know that for me, an OCD poem means violence, terror.
Hmm. You write how blinking is very powerful, and you say blinking seven times memorizes the faces of the people you love. You write about blinking more in the beginning, in the childhood section. Does blinking become less powerful as the book progresses?
It does. And in fact, that was probably the one thing that I would say was a visible external OCD compulsion, where I have another poem in the book called The Face Has Seven Holes that has kind of instructions for drawing a star on people's faces by blinking on their eyes and their mouth and their ears. And that was something that I used to do when I was a child. So you would be talking to me and I would be drawing a star on your face, blinking seven times. And people noticed. And one time in school when I was little, we were playing volleyball and I got hit in the face by the ball, volleyball. Not good with ball sports. And my eyes swelled up and I went to the nurse and someone said, you know, your eye is swollen. Is that why you're blinking so much? And I thought, oh, yes, people are noticing this. That was the first time that I was aware that my compulsion was visible to others. And I knew I didn't want other people to know. So I worked really hard at replacing that compulsion with something else, patterning or counting internally in order to hide.
Let's talk about the counting. And I'm just wondering, you know, counting, it comes up, you write, such a waste, hours lost to counting the window panes in this room. Can you explain the issues with counting and how you write about it in the poem?
Yeah, I also have another poem called It Starts that talks about introducing the concept of counting when I was a child. And I always would look at the window and count the four sides of the window. So right, left, top, bottom. And if you kind of draw that pattern on the window, right, left, top, bottom, it makes a four. And for some reason, OCD makes up its own rules. So four is good. You know, some things feel right, some things are wrong. And four is a good number for me. And so it just feels, when you're worried about something, OCD comes in with a compulsion to say, this is how you settle your fears. This compulsion is a ritualistic kind of settling for you. It helps with the anxiety. But over the years, the compulsions become the problem. Hmm. You know, it's not even so much the fear and the anxiety. It's the fact that I'm counting all the time. What could I accomplish if I wasn't doing that?
There's a line, like, there's a sort of grace in it, after all, counting yourself lucky to be alive. It sounds like you give a little bit of reprieve in that moment, allowance for the counting.
I think so, because this has been something that I dealt with on my own for so long. I learned to sort of adjust to it and keep it as a part of myself that I was able to see some good in. You know, OCD has made me who I am. It's affected my creativity in positive ways. I see and hear things because of OCD that I wouldn't see and hear if I didn't have it.
Madison poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman's collection of poems is a glimpse inside the inner world of a life with obsessive compulsive disorder. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a Madison poet's deeply personal and decades-long struggle with obsessive-compulsive disorder, where a person gets caught in a cycle of obsessions and compulsions. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Marie Hoffman's new collection of poetry is called Exploding Head. Toward the end of your collection, you have a poem. It's titled A Great Many Things. Can you read this poem for us?
Sure. A Great Many Things. In the bath, a galaxy of bubbles collapses in a weightless, glittering mound, marking the end of another day in which you are not dead. Your body and all its invisible particles stitched tightly together sink deeper into this warm, white cradle, weary from the rattling of your own mind. At dusk, walking through the field, you picked a feather from the grass and ran its shimmering vein between your knuckles. You wanted to see how it was held together by peeling apart its hooks and barbs. There was a hush about it, the swish of hands releasing their grasp. You saw how easily the delicate design of the world can be undone. But for now, you are safe in this watery embrace. Each alternate universe bursts around you one by one, releasing a held breath. A great many things will happen to you, but none of the things you're afraid of. It was the wind in your hair, the red-winged birds embroidering the blue sky. That has been your life.
There's this exhale after reading that poem, like, oh, okay. You know, with the safe in this watery embrace, there's a more peaceful tone than some of the poems that came before. What do you think elicits this feeling of safety?
For me, actually, this feeling of safety and this tone that you referred to is something that I discovered over the course of writing the book, and in fact, assembling the book. It was late in the years that I spent writing these poems that I thought, let me just try it in chronological order. Let me just put all the childhood poems first and the later poems later and see how it reads. And when I sat down and read my own work that way and looked at my own life, I found that the childhood years were very scary, very lonely. And the later years, the later poems, I was naturally adopting a tone of self-compassion. I had learned to care for myself, to reassure myself that, hey, I'm safe. All these things that I've worried about, those are not the things that have happened. That was not your life. Even though you spent many hours and days and years over the course of your life imagining horrible things happening, that was just in your mind. You're truly safe. And so that's sort of something that I discovered and found other ways of self-care. Like, for example, this poem takes place in the bathtub, right? A bubble bath. What, you know, it's this nice, warm water. And thinking of just, you know, where can you find places in your own life where you feel safe and protected?
Hmm. Let's go to Jason in Janesville. Jason, hi.
Yes. I have a question. When you noticed your OCD, or even your parents or adults noticed your OCD, was kind of an issue or kind of rearing its head through, did they try to put you on medication or try to, were you able to see this, solve this issue naturally?
Jason, thank you. Yeah, Cynthia.
That's a great question, Jason. My personal story, and I can't speak for others or make recommendations, of course, but I can only speak to my own lived experience. I would say it was more natural as far as the OCD. Cognitive behavioral therapy is something that I had sought for depression and anxiety. And that, even though it wasn't targeted specifically for OCD, it helped me make peace with my thoughts and remember that as long as I don't react to the thoughts, as long as I recognize that the thoughts are just thoughts and they can't harm me, it's not reality. That was the way that I naturally found a safe space for myself with OCD. I did seek medication for anxiety and depression, and those are all things that kind of come along with OCD. I think we're there because of the presence of OCD. So targeting OCD as the base, I think, is what ultimately helped me feel better.
How has motherhood influenced your poetry?
Well, I think that motherhood is such a big part of my life. I have a child. They're 14 years old now, teenager. But over the course of this book, they were really little, you know, a toddler. And as far as OCD, that child that I was suddenly responsible for kind of just clicked right into place with all my other OCD worries. It was yet another person that I loved deeply that OCD made me worry about losing. And so my child does appear quite a bit in the book. And motherhood, I think, is impossible not to write about because it's part of my identity.
So where does your poetry take you next? Where, you know, after this collection and we think about those last words in the bubble bath, you know, where does your poetry go next?
Well, I'm in that place of figuring out what's next. I tend to write, and I think also because of OCD, I have kind of an obsessive personality. And I love to think of crafting a book rather than poem by poem. So I love what we would call in the poetry world project books. You know, this book is on a theme. My previous three books were all on their own theme. I enjoy the act of building a world. So I'm kind of feeling around for the next obsession. I'm writing a little bit about climate change, a little bit more about being the mother of a teenager, and we'll see where that takes me.
What are your suggestions, advice for other poets or people who are in other artistic pursuits as they also navigate an anxiety disorder?
I think just, again, self-compassion and recognizing, you know, I'm a perfectionist, and it wasn't even until recently finding more of an OCD community that I recognized perfectionism as a kind of symptom of OCD. I just thought, oh, I'm a perfectionist. So recognizing that and allowing yourself to just remember that life is messy, make a mess, you know, just allow yourself to be creative and make mistakes and experiment.
Life is messy and experiment. And yet, I wonder, does poetry create some order for you?
Oh, it absolutely does. Even within the prose poem, which is kind of a disordered order, a prose poem, for those who might not know, is just a paragraph. Mm-hmm. It looks like a little piece of prose, you know, just like reading a memoir. And even in that space, I love the structure of the sentence, the musicality of how it builds and then falls. And it is a very lovely, orchestrated space in which to express yourself.
Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your works.
Thank you for having me this morning, Kate.
Cynthia Marie Hoffman is a poet and author in Madison. Her new poetry collection is called Exploding Head. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.